What's up, guys? My name's Abe. I'm a recovered crack cocaine addict and a big old drunk. And been clean and sober since October 20th of 2004. For that, I'm grateful. And I'm emotional because, just like probably everybody here, this place changed the trajectory of my life. It saved my life. And it's where the healing began. Please turn off all cell phones. You know, this place saved all our lives, and we've all got so many stories and so much to share about this place, and there's so much mutual love that I see in so many people interacting. You know, and this is something that we all have in common, is this thing that we walk through. And I remember when I met Chris, first couple meetings of 1313, how many years ago that was? 2007. And I heard his name back from the old days, old Austin punk rock days, and I always knew this dude was like way cooler than us, like 10 years older, old school, you know. But I saw him at a meeting, and I saw the way he carried himself, and I saw the way he was living. And I wanted what this guy had. You know, he's a big dude, just well-spoken, like, funny, with a cute wife. And I was just like, I want to be a big dude with a cute wife. Like, you know, I'd been to meetings, hundreds of meetings, but I heard the way he talked about the third step and the way he talked about the mechanics of the program, the way he talked about being a victim of the delusion that she's going to make me happy, that more is going to make me joyous, that's going to make me free. You know, and that's what I related to. You know, being a victim of that delusion that if only this, then I could be happy. And, you know, this guy just changed my life. You know, and when I saw him working out here, you know, I saw the way he transformed the alumni. And people wanted to be part of alumni, and people were like wanting to be part of this thing again, you know. And I wanted to be part of this thing again. And I called him and I was like, "Hey, man, if I want your job, like," I was like, "I wasn't looking for a job. I was like, I want your job. Whenever that comes open, call me because I want to work with the alumni." And he was like, "Yeah, job's not available, but we got something for you." And I got to work with this guy for the last few years. And I got to see this place. Like, I got to see the change in people's lives. And I got to see this guy even more carry the message every day. And I'm supposed to talk so he doesn't cry, but I'm about to. So here's Chris Gates.
Hey, everybody, I brought a bottle of water and a handkerchief because it's going to be that kind of a night. Somebody said, do you want a tissue? And I was like, no, I'll just end up wearing it. I was like, fucking, yeah. I love you back. So my name's Chris Gates. I am an addict alcoholic. Yeah. And my sobriety date is 10-5 of 1998. And like our buddy Bob says, nobody's more surprised about that than me. You know, that was not a good bet, even 3 weeks earlier. So I say I'm an addict and an alcoholic. What that means is I'm a binge drinker and a low-bottom heroin addict. It took a while to get to heroin. I didn't start there. We'll cover that in the story. I'm a gearhead. Most of you guys know. Yeah, I like to take things apart and put them back together. I mean, I was that 5-year-old who started taking shit apart, and by 7, I could put it back together. I want to know how shit works. You know, when I move into a new house, within 30 minutes of getting there, I know what all the light switches do, because this one, what the fuck, is pissing me off. It makes me feel ineffectual in my life, you know? That's an awesome character asset unless you try to use it to solve a problem that can't be solved with that kind of an asset. And it nearly killed me a few times. I was born here in Austin. I think there's 9 of us that were born here. You know, we meet biweekly. Everybody else, hi. I come from a great family. There's no addicts and alcoholics in my family. Nobody ever did anything funny to me when I was a kid. There's no addicts and alcoholics, but there is some mental illness in my family, a lot of depression. And there's a history of suicide on my mom's side of the family because nobody in my family on either side drinks. And if you have what's wrong with me, wrong with you, and there's no way to fix it, suicide becomes an option. This generation, there's a couple of us, you know. I grew up here. I had a happy childhood. I was a very normal-ish child until the first day of first grade. And then I went to school, and there were 28 other kids in my class, and those kids made me fucking uncomfortable. And I started to eat. Food was my first drug of choice. You know, nobody drank in my house, but there was Little Debbie's, and I ate the shit out of some Little Debbie's, you know. People like to say, used to tell me, well, you were such an active boy, and then you had to sit all day at school, and you started putting on a little bit of weight, and that's an awesome story, and it's horse shit. The malady showed up at 6, and I started eating to fix it. You know, everybody feels weird and different. I was weird and different. At 7, I saw the Rolling Stones on Ed Sullivan and knew that I wanted to be a musician for the rest of my life. At 7. I grew up right by the UT campus. I started listening to music in the late 60s and buying records from hippies at their garage sales and just whatever. It didn't matter. And same 28 kids for all the way through grade school. Never made friends with any of them. I liked them well enough at school, but then I'd go home and never hang out with any of them. You know, that's a recurring theme in my life. I have a lot of proximity buddies and not very many friends because I don't connect with people very well. Also a hallmark of malady. We moved about 8 blocks during sixth grade, and that put me into a different middle school than all the people I went to grade school with. I like to joke, like, I've got twin girls. I now realize that middle school is a holding pen for insane hormonal lunatics, and even the head cheerleader feels weird and left out on the wrong day. But I was weird and left out. You know, I went to a middle school in North Austin where they were all like, you know, North Austin kids, and I had hair down to here, and I was walking around with a tape deck listening to Black Sabbath on this mono. Like, I was different, you know. And I started going to concerts when I was in seventh grade, when I was 12. Like, my mom would just drop me off, you know. Nobody I knew wanted to go. And shockingly, at those concerts, there was a lot of people smoking pot. And at first, it made me really uncomfortable. But after I went to 2 or 3 concerts, they seemed like nice people. And so the next time they passed me the joint, I tried that. And that was quite good, actually. You know, this concert is much more enjoyable with this Mexican dirtweed in my system. And, you know, in 1974, it was much easier to get weed than alcohol as a 13-year-old. And so I started smoking copious amounts of pot in middle school, which is great. It goes good with the food. And I'd smoke a joint on the school bus and eat an entire Boston cream pie on the way home from walking home from the bus, you know. And then high school rolls along. I discover skateboarding. It's, you know, the island of the misfit toys. There was like 20 of us in the whole city doing it. And I was really good in school. Like, I graduated 9th in a class of 450. And when I went to my high school reunion, the first thing somebody said to me when I walked up is, "Did you actually graduate from our school?" I'm like, "Yeah, dude, I just didn't go very much." You know, I started drinking in high school because the drinking age was 18. And by the time I was 13 years old, I was 6 feet tall. I weighed 200 pounds and I had the beginnings of a beard. Getting alcohol wasn't a problem. But it was working then. Right? I mean, I know some of you started blackout drinking before middle school was over. That's not my story. I mean, the broad strokes of my story is I drank and I used for a long time and it was fucking a fun. I had a great time. And then I drank and I used for quite a number of years and it was still fun, but there were starting to be some things that should have been red flags instead of decorations. And then I drank and I used for a few years, whether I wanted to or not. I died 4 times and then I got sober. But in high school, it was still working. It was all going fine. Like, when I graduated high school, I had hair down to here and a big, giant, fuck-off Grizzly Adams beard and 3 months later, my hair was this long and blonde, and I was in a punk band. I found my people. And in that music scene, everybody was drinking copious amounts of beer and smoking a ton of weed. And I'm playing in my first band, and it's awesome. And we start making records, and we start touring, and it's awesome. Now, there are some people in that scene doing meth, and they kind of make me uncomfortable. But by the time I'm 22 years old, I'm drinking so much that I begin to pass out. The only blackouts I ever had were on Rohypnol, and I gave those to myself. Yes, there have been occasions when I took advantage of myself. But I didn't black out, but I passed out. And like my friends liked me, but they couldn't get me back to the car once I dropped. So they'd roll me on my stomach so I didn't pull a Hendrix and leave me wherever I fell. Sometimes that was in the front yard at the party. Sometimes it was in the alley next to the parking lot, next to the diner. And I'd come to and go, and find my way home. And my solution to that was not to slow down on my drinking. It was to go buddy up to my friends who were doing meth. You know, once again, not a reasonable solution, but it made sense at the time. In that community of people doing meth, some of them were shooting it, and they made me real uncomfortable too, but I got to know them, and they didn't seem like bad people. And one thing leads to another. My first band did well. We made 5 or 6 records. We toured the country. It was great. When that band fell apart, I put together another band where, like, a case of beer and a quarter gram of speed was the prerequisite as a warm-up for every gig. You know, show up drunk, show up late, don't show up at all. You know, how loaded can you get and still play your songs? And if you can't play them, that's colorful. You know, that band did pretty well, too. Made a couple of records toward the country. I was in Los Angeles on tour in late 1985, and I stayed. The rest of the band went home. I didn't have anywhere to be because I was dealing meth by this point because, you know, it's cheaper than buying it. And I went to a party, and I saw Guns N' Roses in the basement of this apartment complex play their third show and went, I want to be in a rock band. So I came back home. I packed up my stuff. I moved to Los Angeles, which was largely like recreating middle school. You know, everybody in Los Angeles was skinny and wearing girls' clothes and trying to sound like Poison, and I show up looking like me. You know, the spandex didn't come in my size, so I don't have any funny pictures to explain away, but like nobody wanted to play with me. I didn't want to do what they were doing. I didn't look like you're supposed to look. And 9 months later, I had a record deal. In between moving there and getting the record deal, I met this beautiful little goth girl who had the best meth I had ever seen in my life. And it was love at first 7-day run. You know, the day we met, we stayed up for a week. And she warned me, but I, boy, and I shouldn't, she's just being silly, you know. And I get the record deal. It's my band. I'm writing the music. I'm doing most of the business. Band gets signed, video on MTV. I'm dealing meth with her, like you do. 3 days before we leave on the first tour, the DEA comes through the front door of the cook I'm working with's house. And happily, there was nothing with my name on it. Another one of those, I don't know how I dodged that bullet, but I did. And she and I sat down, and I think we were having a conversation about not doing drugs anymore. At least not dealing drugs anymore. Because in my mind, people like me, fat guys from Texas, don't get record deals. They don't get videos on MTV. They don't get this chance. And I don't want to fuck it up. And I really think, at least in my mind, I thought that was doable. I had no idea how far past that line we both were. And I climbed on a tour bus and went on tour for 3 months. And within 10 days, I was drinking a fifth of vodka and a half a case of beer and doing every bit of cocaine I could talk people out of. And within a week, she was strung out on heroin because neither of us could just not use. And that sort of continued that way for a little while. And then when I'd come back from the tour, I was paying for the dope, so I figured I was going to do some. I'd been up for 8 years. I could use a nap. The malady is progressive, right? The problem of Chris presented itself, and snacks would fix it for a while. And then weed would fix it for a while. And then weed and alcohol would fix it for a while. You know, the thing about meth, most of you know this, is that it removes all doubt. Like, when I'm on meth, whatever I'm doing is exactly what I'm supposed to be doing, even if I'm mowing the yard in the dark at 2 in the morning. You know, it's what I'm supposed to be doing. It removes all of that self-doubt until it doesn't, right? And then, but when I did heroin, it fixed the problem of Chris. That problem did not exist for 6 or 7 hours. And that terrified me and delighted me at the same time. Because it hadn't been comfortable to be me in a really long time. And it's funny because when I got to the program, I had all this animosity towards anything that even remotely smelled like religion. But my motto during this era was, I don't pray for parking spaces. And what that means, what it meant to me then was, I don't ask for little favors. I take care of business, and when I need something, it shows up before I even know I need it. And that's how my life always worked. And as soon as I realized that heroin was the solution to the problem of me, I knew that deal with the universe was over, and I was not wrong. At that point in time in Los Angeles, as long as your records were still making people money, they did not care what you were doing. Everyone was strung out. And first couple of records, like the second record didn't sell as good as the first one because I was really deep in the heroin, and it is not a party record. The songs are kind of dark, you know. The record rocks, but it's a little fucking bleak, like my friend just died and here I'm homeless again, and like, these are not party topics. I was in the studio writing the third record when Nevermind came out. We were on the same label as Nirvana, and that was the day it was over. Like, Guns N' Roses phone calls stopped getting returned on that day while everybody was trying to figure out how to take credit from Nirvana at the label. And all the guys in my band had been in successful punk bands. We saw the writing on the wall. We called it a day and went our separate ways. And I ended up getting a job working for a fashion accessories designer running their production facility. And I realized after 6 months that he was paying me well enough to afford to stay strung out indefinitely. And that scared me. And so after considering my options, I sold my motorcycle and half of my crap and bought the shittiest van I could afford and put the rest of my crap into it, deciding I was coming back to Austin. I got to get out of it. Problem is Los Angeles. You know, my girlfriend at the time was not speaking to me because I wouldn't pay for her dope anymore. And the day before I left, she asked if she could come. I said, sure. You know, so we climbed into the van together. It took 4 days to get from L.A. to here, even though it's only a 26-hour drive, because heroin is not a really good cross-country drug. There was a lot of napping in parking lot. Rest area. Yeah. We got back to Austin. We landed at my dad's house. I thought moving would fix it. We brought enough pills to kick while we got, as soon as we got back to town. And we did. And we stayed, you know, not what recovery would call sober, but I don't know what we were doing. Nobody had drank in my dad's house. We didn't have any money. Maybe we were stone cold sober. I don't know. About 3 weeks after we got there, my girlfriend had some sort of a psychic break. We had to call EMS. And they kept asking us what she was on. And the truth is, what I know now is she was on untreated malady. Like, her mind broke just having to be herself. And they had to put her in the hospital and sedate her for 3 or 4 days. And when she got out, we brushed off our Spanish, we went to Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, and within a couple of hours, we had found a way to find heroin. And once moving didn't work, for me, it's like all bets were off. You know, I'm a nice boy from a good family, and I didn't care if I lived or died anymore. I was too chicken to kill myself, but I didn't care if I died, which meant I didn't care if you died. And I got reckless, and I didn't care. And I put myself in a lot of really dangerous situations with people who are much badder, much worse people than me. People for whom prison is not a deterrent, you know. And it's another one of those things, it's a miracle I made it through that, because those people have a tendency, especially if you have a little money in your pocket, of just killing you and taking the money. I'm not part of their family. I'm never going to be part of their family. And things just got worse. You know, I had a roommate, 21 years old, who got caught with a small amount of cocaine, was terrified that he was going to go to prison, went on a 9-day coke shoot and run, and then killed himself in my house on purpose. People were dropping like flies all around me. I spent every day the last 2 years I was using trying to figure out how to not use. I can't count the times I detoxed myself. I can't count the times, you know, I went, signed up for methadone just long enough to not be sick when I quit a couple of weeks later. I also went to about 10 AA meetings, the same one every time. Don't do that. you know, they were fond of saying, just don't drink no matter what, and fucking off and going to dinner and leaving me with no assistance whatsoever. I reached out for the hand of AA, and it let me die four times because it was busy trying to sleep with each other, you know. There were a couple of people that tried to help, but not one of them ever mentioned this place. Not one of them ever said, what are you going to do about the detox? They just wished me the best and wanted to support me however they could. You know, one of the things that you people know is not just how to work the steps, it's what the resources in this area are. You know, it's important that we put that in our toolkit too. You know, the last 4 months I was using, I coded four times. EMS, brought back by a roommate who I didn't know knew CPR, you know, that sort of thing. Like, I always joke, I had to do a stress test for an insurance thing about 10 years ago, and they're looking at the printout, and they go, when did you have your heart attack? And I went, I never had a heart attack. I went, wait a minute, would that Pulp Fiction thing count? And the doctor, the tech looked at me and went, yeah. And I went, I did that at least twice in 98. I had heart attacks. I just wasn't there for them. One of the things I've always done my whole life is if there's anything about music on television, I'm watching it. Like, there was so little information for my music-starved mind growing up. Record covers, the occasional magazine if I could afford it. Like, fucking Sonny and Cher summer variety show, I'm watching it. Don't care, it's music. And I was flipping the channels this one day. Well, back up. I was sitting in my desk putting a target sight on a pistol for my dad because the only thing we still have in common is shooting together, and he's too old to put the sights on himself. And I find myself sitting at my desk. My dealer shows up, and I find myself sitting at my desk with a gun in one hand and a rig in the other trying to decide which one to use. And not that thing, I know you've done it, don't lie, you've done it. Not that, why doesn't somebody come save me? Just sitting there calmly trying to decide today or forever, what's my choice? And for just an instant, I could see myself and going, how the fuck did those become the only choices in my life? They're the only choices. But I used to have a life full of possibility, and it's all come down to this. And there has to be a better way to live, and I do not know what it is. And then later that day, I'm channel surfing high as a kite because I didn't use the gun. And I come across this episode of 2020, the news magazine. They're doing a feature about this jazz saxophone player from the 50s and 60s named Buddy Arnold. And I'm watching, okay, jazz saxophone, whatever. And they're talking about all the guys he played with and showing this whole cool video. And then they say, and he was a heroin addict for 30 years. And I'm going, well, that's a weird thing to include. But it turns out the story wasn't about his musical career. It was about the fact that he had just founded an organization funded by the Grammys whose sole purpose was to send musicians to rehab. And I'm going, oh, shit, that's my shot. That's it. And so I wrote down the name of the organization, and I ran in the other room and got on my computer and looked up their website. It took 4.5 minutes to load because it was 1998. AOL squealing at me for 5 minutes, and there was one tiny picture and the page wouldn't load. But I got their information, and I called them the next day, and I would love to say I was willing and teachable, but I had also just signed up to go back to ACC because what I really need is some better education. And they wanted me to go to treatment for 30 days, and school started in 26 days. And I said, can I leave a couple days early so I don't miss the first day of school? And they said, call back when you really want to go. And I went, okay. And so I hung up, and I went to school for 4 days. And I called them up and said, I'm ready to go. And so they gave me the phone number of a place out in the hill country. And then I called that place, and I received what was ultimately the second real gift. That TV show was the first gift. The second gift was they said, oh, you're on methadone, we can't take you. Stop taking the methadone, we'll see you in 6 weeks. And what they were telling me without being able to say it out loud for legal reasons is we can't deal with the methadone detox. You won't get anything out of a 30-day rehab if you come here on that much methadone. Just stop taking it, go back to full-time heroin use, we can deal with that detox, we'll see you in 6 weeks. And so I had to do that, and that turned out to be a gift because I hadn't been working completely without a net in a while. And I had to spend 6 weeks finding a way to come up with that money and do things that I could barely stand to do in order to just be right enough to make it to the starting line. It was a brutal 6 weeks. Third gift I received was my ex who, you know, she was, you know, we always had that one person around us who's more fucked up than we are. That was always her. And she sat me down and said, you better think about why you're going. Because if you go for the wrong reason, I'm afraid if it doesn't work, the next time you'll die for good. So I sat down, not knowing anything about recovery, and said, why am I going? Am I going because I'm living in a house that caught fire, and the only reason I didn't die in the fire was because a bunch of ammo and firecrackers exploded and woke me up, and I put the fire out, and we didn't tell the landlord because we can't afford to move, so we just don't go in the burned up part anymore. Am I going because every time I walk out my front door, I'm committing a felony? Every time? Am I going because I have more warrants than I'm even aware of, and everything on my car is either expired or forged? And I realize that's not why I'm going. All that stuff sucks. But the reason I'm going is because I can't function without this drug that's used for... The level of opiates in my system is used for amputation on the battlefield, and I have to use it to go to the fucking grocery store. And I have to believe there's a way to function without this, without these drugs, and I have no idea what it is. So I'm trusting that maybe they do. That was a gift, because I watch a lot of people come into rehab and say they want to be sober, and as soon as some manageability returns, they are right back at it again. What they wanted was manageability. That's fine, but you need to be clear on what you're after. And I'm glad that I was clear about that beforehand, because it didn't leave me any back doors. I landed in rehab. I had no idea 12 steps was going to be a part of it, which was good. It didn't give me time to work up any arguments. I stumbled up the hill to my first on-campus meeting out of the detox unit, and they started talking about God. My head cleared through the meds for a minute. I went, oh, fuck, I'm at church school. And that's the last thing I remember. You know, terrified me. Terrified me. They're talking about God's the answer, and I'm going, then I'm fucked. You know, I mean, 70% of my life has been spent doing stuff nobody else wants to do, and I'm fine with that. But the other 30% was spent watching people who were not smarter than me, did not have more resources than me, have a better life than me, doing stuff I can't seem to manage. And I thought this was going to be another one of those, because I don't believe in God, and I'm not gonna. And they're saying, fake it till you make it. And I'm going, fuck you, I don't think that works. You know. But fortunately, there was a guy there who looked like me. And, I mean, I was at an expensive rehab where everybody had nice skin and all their teeth. I didn't have any of that, you know. But there was a guy that worked there covered in tattoos. You know, his life and mine were remarkably similar, only he kept going to jail for stuff that I never quite got convicted for. And I believed him. And he sat down and he talked to me about the steps. You know, he talked to me about powerlessness and how it relates to the physical allergy. And, you know, once I put the drugs and alcohol in my system, I can't control what's going to happen, you know, and I came to understand that powerless doesn't mean I can't ever control my using. It means I can't always 100% of the time control my using. Normal people can always 100% of the time control how much they use. They might make a mistake once in a while and do a little too much, but it's literally a mistake. It's not like rolling the dice like it is for me. And he helped me understand the unmanageability was not the chaos of my life. It was... The real unmanageability was the mental obsession and what happens when I try to quit on my own and try to just be Chris without some sort of solution to the problem of Chris. And I spent 2 weeks arguing about steps 2 and 3 with everybody in the rehab because I heard him in a meeting say God either is or he isn't, and I figured we should decide because the church needs to know. And then I just went, you know, fuck this. There were 70 people there. 68 of them were not there for their first treatment episode, and 60 of them never did a 4-step. And I don't even know what that is, but nobody's paying for me to come again. So whatever you didn't do, I got to do. You know, my understanding of steps 2 and 3 is a little more nuanced now. You know, it's, you know, step 2 doesn't have anything to do with belief. The only belief I need in step 2 is, do I believe that there's a spiritual solution to the problem I've been trying to solve with drugs and alcohol? The problem of Chris. If you're an addict, your problem is not drugs and alcohol. It's being you and just functioning at all. Am I willing to believe that there's a spiritual solution to the problem of being Chris? And that coming to believe was a matter of identification for me. That's why the program works. You know, this guy Ray that worked at the treatment center, he told me his story and he asked me, do you think we're the same? And I went, yeah, you're a little dumber than me because you kept going to jail. But, you know... But he was 10 years sober, and he said, do you think I'm just better at not getting high than you? I said, I don't think so. He said, why not? I said, because you seem happy. I spent like 3 days trying to not get high. I'm going to kill myself or somebody else. You know, I can't imagine 10 years would make you happy. He said, right. Are you willing to believe me when I tell you I took the actions of these steps, and being me is not a problem anymore? That problem is solved. And so I came to believe Ray. And then Step three was just a decision to work the rest of the steps. Stop thinking about it so much. And get into the work. So I did. Another one of the gifts I received is some of you overthink. Show of hands. Right. We can sort of be evenly divided into two categories. People who are doing everything they can to go back to sleep and not think ever. And any thought is an imposition, and why are you ruining my sleep? And then there are those of us who can't stop thinking no matter how hard we try. I'm one of those. But very early on, and I don't know how this happened or why this happened, I can't pinpoint when it happened, but that overactive thinking mind stopped trying to think of ways not to have to do this shit and started trying to figure out how to do it better and be more efficient at it. And to tear it apart, tear apart what people were telling me about how it worked, because some of it sounded like bullshit and some of it was. Sitting around turning shit over to God, that's not one of the steps. There's work to do, almost always. You know, I was at a meeting earlier today and it occurred to me we were talking about spiritual experience and thinking is not a spiritual experience. You can't think a spiritual experience. You have to take an action to gain an experience. Only action brings experience. And only action around spiritual tools brings spiritual experience. Period. And I don't know when the shift happened in me, but I started using my overactive mind to try and take this apart and put it back together in the simplest way possible, because simple's hard. It's super easy to have something complicated and wrong, but simple and right is hard to do. It's the mistakes reveal themselves pretty fucking quickly. And I stayed sober. I found a group of guys. I had a hard time finding my people when I got out. You know, I stumbled out of treatment and I'm going to meetings every day and they're all full of like weird rednecks or old hippies. And I'm going, where the fuck are the tattooed punk rock junkie dudes? And they're all on Red River wondering where I went, you know, calling each other going, what's the fuck's Kate's doing? Like, they got over it for a couple of years. I met them later in one of these rooms. But I wandered into this room and there was a guy, his band and my band used to play together. And like we literally, for a year, his band, my band, another band would draw straws once a month when we played at the Continental Club to see what order we played in, because whoever played last was going to be too drunk to play their own songs. And that was still funny back then. And I knew him in L.A. And he was not a happy guy. He played guitar for another guy that was on my label, and he was not a happy guy. And now I walk into this room, there's John, and he's laughing and he's smiling. And I went, all right, I'm staying. I saw myself in the room. If he thinks the rest of these guys are okay, I'll guess they'll be okay for now. I don't know. They seem weird to me. But I stayed. And I know I've returned that favor, because more than one person has said they, you know, snuck into a meeting and walked in and went, ah, fuck, there's Gates. You know, I guess I have to stay because he was way worse than me. You know. And I got sober in October of 1998, but my recovery didn't really start for about another year. I was sober that whole time. But my first sponsor was a very well-meaning guy who could not show me the mechanics of the program at all. You know, he was a good ear. He was supportive. He pointed me in the right direction, but he didn't give me any tools. And then I met this guy. I moved to a different home group because my home group, the people with long-term sobriety, were out of their fucking minds. And I needed a better example of what was possible, because if that's it, I'm out. You know, 5 meetings a day and losing my mind and getting a divorce 15 years in. It's like, dude. Like maybe one, but all of them, you know. So I went to this other meeting and I met this guy, and he was doing something he loved for a living and making good money at it, and married to this woman who was fond of saying that her relationship with God was more important than her marriage to Jeff. And he showed me the mechanics, and he introduced me to Joe and Charlie, and I began to have an actual set of actionable tools. Like, I knew what I was supposed to do. The inventory became a very clear process. Step 6 and 7 became an actual process and not just like thinking about God a little bit and getting on with my business. You know, developing a daily practice around prayer and meditation, you know, which was a struggle because like, how do I pray? I don't believe in God. My sponsor said, figure it out. It's not optional. You know, the only way to tell how many parts of the steps you can leave out and stay sober is leave shit out till you're not sober. That was too many, you know. And so I had to find a way to pray that worked for me. I did, you know. I couldn't meditate because I had more than one voice in my head when I got sober, and they weren't all me some days. And I couldn't sit cross-legged on the floor. I'm a fat guy, you know. But there's lots of ways to meditate. And so I found a way that worked for me that was practical. It's not optional. Step 11, no part of step 11 is optional. doing 10 steps in real time is not optional. You might be able to stay sober. You will not build a big, cool life. I don't know why you got sober. I know why I got sober, and it wasn't to hide out in some AA church basement and have a little tiny fucking life and be Mr. AA. You know, I want to have the biggest, coolest fucking life I can have. I want to do stuff that freaks me out and then work steps on it so it doesn't freak me out anymore so I can keep doing it and then do something else that freaks me out. You know, I thought my musical career was over. And then 10 months after I got sober, I got a call from this guy in L.A. who wanted me to come out and mix this live recording that my band in L.A. had done that had never been released. And so I went, okay, and I flew out to L.A. to mix the album. And then somebody there heard we might be going to do some shows. And so we got offered a string of shows without the blues. So now we're putting the band back together. And that's weird. You know, I'm stone cold sober. That's weird. And it was awesome. And I got to go to Europe a bunch of times. And I got to go to Japan. And I got to tour the country again. And I got to make great music, stone cold sober, and enjoy it. And when I stopped enjoying it, I stopped doing it. And, you know, I wanted a real relationship. Like, I didn't want to keep having those two-year-long relationships just starting a bunch of heat and ending a bunch of flames. You know, I couldn't keep doing what I was doing. And my sponsor walked me through a process that gradually led me to this. I can't look at her. And shut up. The main thing is I'm not special. I just really do this. I mean, I really do. And I remember being about 2.5 years sober and being pissed off because I was having to do way more step work than anybody I knew. Like, they were just hanging out doing dumbass crap, and I was losing my fucking mind. And, like, I always thought some are sicker than others meant that those relapsing people were sicker than me. But it turns out I'm the sick one because the wind changes direction, and I can't decide whether to kill myself or quit my job, you know. And just like, and my sponsor said, I understand. You really are having to do more step work than most of these people. But I want you to sit back and watch their lives. And so I did. And what I realized that all of us were doing is we had set up these quiet lives because I saw a lot of people in the program setting up a quiet life. But I never wanted a quiet life, and apparently my friends didn't either, because about once every 3 or 4 months, they just light themselves on fire for no reason and then spend months putting the fire out and rebuilding their life. Like standing up and, I'm going to sleep with her, you know, like, you know, I'm going to quit my job. What are you going to do next? I don't know. I have no job skills. Like, oh, no, now I'm homeless. Ah, like, it's just crazy. Like, and I was doing it too. I mean, 80% of the chaos in my life wasn't caused by me. It was allowed by me because the people I was close to. But once I decided to stop causing my own chaos, I also started cutting those people out of my life and started trying to take things on purpose. We called it positive chaos. Like, what challenge can I take on purpose that's going to be just as hard as getting out of that last stupid relationship, but my life is bigger once I get to the other side? And I've been doing that for nearly 20 years now. And my life just keeps getting bigger. Like, I got no fucking idea where I'm going to be in 3 months. No idea. And I also have no fear about that. And some of that may be delusion. But I didn't know I was going to work here until the job presented itself. I had topped out at my last job. I was making more money than I had ever made legally. But I was at the end of what I could do with that company. And literally, I ran into a guy from my original home group who was on the board here right after they got rid of the Houston Council. And he said, we need somebody like you out there. Will you come work for us? It's a terrible idea. We're going out of business. He was right. Just took 6 years, you know. But the challenge of being out here has been, I've done a shitload of inventory out here. You know, the alumni pissed me off. My coworkers pissed me off. The job scares me to death. They're going to see who I am. They're going to see me, you know. And they did. And then they kept making me do more stuff. It's like, but that's the beauty. The beauty of the program for me is like, and I talk about it all the time, is I had so much anxiety all my life. So much. I was having panic attacks on heroin, which my psychiatrist says is impossible, but I did it anyway. But I haven't had a panic attack since I started making amends at 4 months sober. Not one. And I don't have any free-floating anxiety today. And that's because every day is 95% of life is the same shit over and over again. You hear me say it all the time. And I got to get good at it. And how I get good at it is by working the fucking steps on it. Not, you know, hoping for the best and trusting God, but doing the inventory to see why it didn't go good and how I can do better but next time. Get some clarity with that self-examination step. And then try to get better connected to my higher power, because my thinking is largely driven by my spiritual condition. So it don't matter how much I want to think good. If I'm spiritually disconnected, I'm going to be thinking like a crazy person. But if I do that action on small stuff, I get good at the 95%. So when the 5% happens, like what's going on right now, I don't have to be freaked out by it because I'm good at the day in, day out. I don't have to worry about taking care of business. And if I'm not good at the 95%, when the big things happen, I stop doing the little shit and the little shit buries me. You know, it's an amazing place to be. You know, I don't have a lot of free-floating anxiety today. I don't have much fear today because I'm building today on the shoulders of yesterday, and I know exactly why yesterday went well. And that means I don't have to be afraid about tomorrow, because tomorrow's just going to be more of today, largely. So I don't have to be afraid about the future. I read this great quote that says, "It said the only way to be prepared for any moment in the future is to be present and effective in this moment right now. So that when that moment arrives, I'm as connected and present as I can be for it. And all the time I spend worrying about the future pulls me out of this moment, which is the only time I have to take an action." You know, I always tell a story about my first spiritual awakening. I worked the shit out of the steps for about 14 months, and then I went to a reunion at the treatment center I went to. There were about 400 or 500 people there. And one of the original meetings I went to, there a lot of the meetings back 22 years ago, they said the Lord's Prayer at the end, but I'm not saying the Lord's Prayer. Fuck you, not a Christian. Blah, blah, blah. I'm going to sit here and hold your hands, but I'm not saying your prayer because I'm awesome like that. And I looked around the room to see who else wasn't praying so I could find the cool people. And that was my awesome spiritual program. I don't care what you believe anymore. It's awesome. Knock yourself out. But that's what I did all the time. And I went to this reunion. Hundreds of people there. Great speaker all morning. We took a break for lunch. 400 people holding hands. And I'm looking around the circle seeing who's not praying. And I get halfway around that circle. And it occurs to me that if even half of these people were remotely as insane and miserable as me when I came here, this is a miracle. Miracle. Like 400 crackheads and meth addicts and heroin addicts and alcoholics fully clothed and in their right minds in Kerrville on a Saturday. Like, it's a miracle. And the word actually had substance for once. It didn't mean lucky. It meant miracle. You know? Miracle. I always laugh because I saw a lot of you on the worst day of your life. An awful lot of you landed here, and I see you on that first day, and you'd be like, and I'd see that look like, I've made a mistake. This is really stupid. I'm just going to go. It was an overreaction. That was yesterday was bad, but it's, I mean, and I, you know, and then I get to see the lights come on, and I get to see you build lives. Doesn't get much better than that. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of you. I've buried 100 of you in 6 years who just couldn't seem to get it. But that's part of the deal too. Maybe the next version of the next life they have, they won't struggle from this as much. I hope so. I hope this version of their troubles is over. You know, I don't know where we're going as a community, but we're going somewhere. You know, you have to take your own cars. Mine's small. But I want to try to keep the fellowship together. We have some plans. Our Tuesday meeting at Club 101 will continue on. I am working right now on putting together a monthly speaker meeting, hopefully at Gateway South on William Cannon and Westgate. I'm meeting with them this week to talk about using their facility once it's safe to put 100, 200 people in a room indoors. The idea behind that is it's going to be 12-step recovery, not AA, not NA, not CA. 12-step recovery. I don't give a shit what your drug of choice was. It's not what we're here to talk about. You know, I want speakers from every fellowship because I'm tired of everybody being in a silo. I'm tired of not knowing awesome people from other programs. you know, and so we're going to do that. We're going to do other stuff. But it's up to you guys. If you want this family to keep going, we need you to show up for it. You know, I don't know what shape it's going to take. Maybe it will dissipate. Maybe it served its purpose. I don't know. You know, if the alumni doesn't ever do one more thing, it served its purpose. Because you're all alive. Thanks. Yeah.